The lecture that follows is being given by Charles Misner at the University of Maryland as one of the general relativity seminars on Tuesday, the 3rd of October, 2006. Okay, well, this talk is a repeat of one I gave in Erice at the Ettore Majorana School there in the town at the top of a mountain on the west side of Sicily. There have been many summer schools there, and this year was the opening of a John Archibald Wheeler International School on Astrophysical Relativity, I think is the official name of it. And so I was asked to give one of the inaugural talks, and that's where all this came from. Organizers, Richard Matzner and Ignazio Schufolini, also asked me afterwards if I would prepare a text of the talk. And because, although they had taped it, the tapes weren't practical as far as I could see. I never got any sign that I could get hold of them. So I decided that I would give it again and tape it, which is what all this apparatus is for. It's experimental physics in the sense that when this talk is over, I will take the file that's on this little gadget, put it on my computer, and let some program transcribe it for me, and we'll see how well that works. So the program advertises that it's 99.9% accurate, which would mean only about 5 corrections per page. But I doubt that it's going to come anywhere near that. So, but we'll see. And it might be some help in preparing the texts. So that's now an alternative to this is John Wheeler and the recertification of general relativity as true physics, because I think that was the most important contribution he made, was to pull general relativity out of the discard file and get people, large numbers of good people, actively working on it. So that's what I'm going to concentrate on. But just to mention that John Wheeler has gone through several different phases, each lasting about 20 years. The first, where I didn't know him, except the very end of it, he's concentrated on a view that the universe can be understood in terms of particles, and in particular, he did a lot of work in nuclear physics along that line, but he also defined the S matrix early in the 30s and did various other work that he was known for. The period I'm going to concentrate on is the second one, where I worked with him closely in parts of it. And that was when he decided it wasn't going to be all particles, it was going to be all fields. And he started out with gravity and electromagnetism and worked through those 20-some years until he retired. And upon retiring as a professor in Princeton, he moved to take a professorship in Texas at Austin. And there his interests, by then they had begun in Princeton, but his concentration was then on information, and his motto was it from bit. Many of his best students at that time were in this area of interpretation of quantum mechanics and the trying to understand the nature of information relevant to physics. So, but I'll give you a bit of a outline here. Born in 1911, which means he celebrated his 95th birthday this summer. He got a PhD from Johns Hopkins in 1933, and it was amusing for me to read recently by director of the APS History of Physics Center, Spencer Wirt, yeah. Spencer Wirt had a Physics Today article summarizing 50 years of the American Institute of Physics, and he said, imagine a graduate student 50 years ago what he would have gone through. He said a 100-year-old graduate student now, who what he would have seen in the past 50 years. And I remarked to him that it doesn't have to be a hypothetical graduate student. John Wheeler was a graduate student at age 19 in 1931 when the AIP was founded. And in his autobiography, he describes his interactions with postdocs and others, what kind of physics he was seeing at those times, and continues on through. So he was actually participating in physics for those entire 50 years. As I say, just a few weeks before he became 22, he got his PhD. He was still 21 when he got his PhD at Johns Hopkins. Then he went to North Carolina. Well, he had a postdoc with a man who then was in Chicago, but now more recently was Bright. So he had a postdoc with Bright. But then his second postdoc was at the Bohr Institute it wasn't called the Bohr Institute then, with Niels Bohr, and that was a very important development, and he continued to interact with and admire Bohr all his life. Immediately on returning from that, he got married and went to North Carolina as an assistant professor, and then a couple of years later, 3 years later, I guess, he turned down tenure at North Carolina to move to Princeton as an assistant professor because he thought it was a more lively atmosphere for physics. Then with the discovery of fission, he and Bohr put together a liquid drop model that was allowed one to estimate some of the important parameters of fission. And then things became much more classified, and he worked throughout the Second World War on the development of the A-bomb, and was principally responsible for the fission for the operation at Hanford, which was to produce plutonium in a pile. Then after the war, he came back and encouraged the beginnings of some cosmic ray research at Princeton, and tried to get back into nuclear physics with things like a collective model, which he was late in publishing. But then the war distracted him again, as there was a call, political call, to produce the H-bomb. And he was, after the war, and late in the war, he was very much motivated by the fact that he had a brother he admired very much, who was in fact fighting in Europe. And this brother was, or maybe not in Europe, but anyway, the brother was fighting, and he always felt that if only the A-bomb had come 3 or 4 months earlier, his brother might still be alive. So he was very much concerned about that. I think he also felt that he didn't pay enough attention to politics when he was in Copenhagen at the Bohr Institute, and that if one had thought more about what was going on and not just let Hitler have his own way for many years, that also the world would have been a better place, and some of the troubles of World War II could have been avoided. So he was always hawkish on strong defense. I think in particular, some of his colleagues at Princeton and others didn't think he played an admirable role in the Oppenheimer hearings. You know, Oppenheimer was unenthusiastic about the H-bomb initially on good scientific grounds, because all the proposals were impossible and never have worked. But later, when a way to do it was done. The Strauss, the head of the AEC, really didn't like him, and Teller thought he was didn't like Oppenheimer, and Teller didn't like Oppenheimer. You can read about that in the book about Oppenheimer that's recently come out. And so their way of getting Oppenheimer out of the councils was not just to say, well, we want an advisory committee that will pursue defense, and since you're not enthusiastic about it, we'll replace you. Instead, they said, we will. But that would have been difficult since he was the hero of the World War II A-bomb and so forth. So instead, they attacked his loyalty and claimed he was not a reliable person to have secrets because he might be favorable to the communists or something, which, I mean, he certainly had a communist background that was well known to all the authorities when they appointed him director. And Wheeler didn't really take any strong statements in his support, said so little that he was considered to be supporting this approach to just get rid of Oppenheimer on any grounds. So that caused a number of hard feelings. But he did spend a lot of time on the H-bomb, much of it eventually done in the neighborhood of Princeton, just outside the university on Route 1. And that came to an end in 52. I arrived in Princeton in 53, so that was just finishing up, and he was just free to start doing something else, which turned out to be gravity. Okay, so the main part of the talk is to talk about those years where he was focusing on gravity and related things, but then he, at age 65, retired from Maryland for the purpose of going to Texas, Princeton. He retired from Princeton for the purpose of going to Texas and spent 10 years there until he had some health problems. He had a bypass and retired, moved to a place called Meadow Lakes, just outside Princeton, in Hightstown, where he has been living ever since. And just in the past year, instead of he and his wife running their own apartment and taking pretty much care of themselves, they've required some of the assisted living and such things that are available there. So currently, this summer was the first time he did not get to his house in Maine, ever since he bought it in 1955. As you can calculate, he's 95 years old. His wife is actually 98. And they are continuing to live there, but Wheeler's hearing is so poor that it's difficult to have a conversation with him. But he does hire a secretary to come around a few hours every week to work on whatever he is still trying to work on. And Ken Ford says that he did, in fact, publish a chapter in a book, write a chapter in a book that was published this year. So he's not totally out of everything, but he's under very difficult circumstances right now, I would say. Okay. Now, 3 years ago, there's a picture of him. 3 years ago, he received the first Einstein Prize, which has since gone to Bryce DeWitt, and is there anyone else who's received it since then? Bergman. What? Bergman. Peter Bergman at the same time as John Wheeler, and then Bryce DeWitt received it just before he died. But the prize needs contributors. If there are any highly comfortable people, financially comfortable people in the room, they could consider donating to that prize through the Physical Society. Okay. So, Wheeler was always a teacher. And he talks about teaching in order to learn. He, in fact, as we said, after the H-bomb work was finished and he settled down to do full-time physics, he, the first thing he did was ask to be assigned to teach the relativity course, and he says in his autobiography that the that he wanted to learn relativity, and the best way to learn anything is to teach it. So that's what he did. And he taught at that course for a few years, but the first year, I guess, was the biggest learning experience. And when he taught other things, such as the freshman honors physics, or probably, I don't know, I haven't heard of him teaching the regular introductory pre-med course or something like that, but he did teach freshman physics on many occasions, and he would always start out with inspiration. He would start out making sure the students felt that there was something that they were going to be really happy to learn going on here, and he would typically start by describing the current research he was doing or that his students were doing. And he would gradually move from a lecture or a lecture and a half on current forefront physics that he was enthusiastic about into some of the background needed for that. And he would eventually get around to vectors and acceleration and things of that sort. Yeah. Yeah. So with his research students, there's this third point up there. He thinks questions are really at least as important, or more, maybe more important than the answer. If you pick the really right question, then there's some point to a lot of hard work, because you can probably find an answer. It wasn't the right question if it can't be answered in some way. And so he was always interested in what are the important questions to be focused on at any given time. And when he thought he had the right question, he would put a lot of and continuing effort into it. But he always worked with students. He has a rather small fraction of his papers that are single-author papers by himself. There are perhaps a number of single-author papers where the author is one of his students, but John was actually one of the major contributors. So he often would let his students, encourage his students to publish, whereas many other people would have put their name on the same paper because there was a lot of interaction going on. And in many other cases, he was actually involved in work with students, and their names would often, well, I think as a standard practice, all his papers were alphabetical, which almost always put his name at the end. So I think he finally met a student in Texas who didn't qualify. Right, Zurich. Okay, so that was one of his things. But he really believed that students not only do the physics, but they ask so many questions that you have to think hard. They come at things from different angles, et cetera, so that he really appreciated the opportunity to work with students and felt that he could get a lot more physics done by letting them interfere and collaborate. Now, when I set about to prepare this lecture for Eriche, since the focus was on those 20 years at Princeton, it turned out that just as he went from Princeton to Texas, there was a book prepared as a gift to him by Peter Putnam, one of his students, and that book attempted to gather from anyone who had benefited from their association with Wheeler to write some comments to be included. So it was just, they asked for letters to John Wheeler to be put in the book, and a CV and a list of students. So this was to give John a chance. So that means I just had to pull out my copy of this and let that do a lot of the talking of what was going on in those 20 years. So that's what I'm going to do next. And start with a list of the students from the back of the book. They were organized by dates, and of course Some of his early students were known to everybody, certainly Richard Feynman, but Arthur Whiteman was a very prominent field theorist at Princeton for many, many years, and a leader in the field. Of course, Ole Bohr was not actually a student of John's, but he came with his father to Los Alamos during World War II, and John, of course, visited Copenhagen many times immediately after the war and saw a lot of Ole Bohr. Ole felt that he had had a close enough association with John that he wanted to be included in this list of people who were making a tribute to John. Then we go on to the 50s. We start out here with, in the early 50s, people who are mostly nuclear physics. John Toll wasn't, but John Toll was sort of, he did dispersion relations, so he was doing some field theory with John. Ken Ford was one of his later nuclear physics students, and later in life, Ken Ford, with some support from the Sloan Foundation, was able to spend a lot of time helping John Wheeler put together an autobiography, which was published a few years ago. Ken still is in Philadelphia. He goes and sees John several times a month and tries to help him with his correspondence and things like that. And, of course, Jim Griffin, who I think was John's last nuclear physics student, has been an important member of this department for many, many years after having spent some time at Los Alamos before he came here. Larry Willits is also a very well-known nuclear physicist in Washington State, I believe, leads one of the major groups that's as important as the one here. I'm not sure about Hill, but, I mean, he did very important work at that time. But I don't keep track of nuclear physics, so I can't tell you all these things. Now, then John was going into relativity. His first PhD student was Art Komar, who did some things on quantum gravity, and postdoced with Peter Bergman, and was thereafter more associated in his work with Bergman than with Wheeler. And he served various times at the National Science Foundation as the gravitation program officer, usually just substituting for a year for somebody who was off on sabbatical. Joe Weber was with John Wheeler went to the Institute for Advanced Study so he could work with Wheeler as he was getting into general relativity. And Wheeler gave him a lot of encouragement on his development of gravitational wave ideas. In 1955, Joe Weber, myself, and Peter Putnam accompanied Wheeler to Leiden in the Netherlands, where he was a visiting professor for one semester, the spring semester there. And Tullio Reggi came to visit at that time. I'll have some notes about from Tullio Reggi about that experience a little later. So I was there. There was a number of other people, some of whom were well known here, like Dieter, John Clauder, who's now down in Florida, I believe, and has played, and Jim Hartle was actually a undergraduate working with Wheeler and with Dieter Brill. There's a very important paper of Brill-Hartle, which came out of Hartle's senior thesis, I guess, unless it was his junior thesis. Senior thesis, okay. It was published in the PhysRev. Peter Putnam, this a very eccentric and interesting guy, who was responsible for gathering all this stuff together, was a student of John's, first as an undergraduate, and then during the time I was there, he came back as a graduate student finished a PhD. But his main interest was Eddington's fundamental theory, and John got him away from that long enough to do a PhD. He worked around Route 128 in Boston, and every time he was offered a raise, he would say, no, give me some stock instead. So he accumulated stock in some of the startup companies of the 1950s in Route 128. And later on, arranged, but I think also with support at that stage. He tried to avoid using his mother's money for anything. She was of a Putnam family from the publishing company. But he arranged a large gift, I'm sure a substantial amount of it, from himself. He gave all his stock to the university and said, don't sell it until I tell you. And he told them at exactly the right time, about 20 years later, and they collected their millions, and bought fabulous pieces of sculpture of absolutely first-rate people that are scattered around the campus at Princeton. He gave it to Princeton, yeah. Then here's some more from the 60s, the next generation there. David Sharp was very active. I knew him very well and worked with him. Went to Los Alamos and did a lot of things. Carol Kukosh, I think we all know. Jim York, who had a long career at Chapel Hill and is now at Cornell, with important contributions in recent years to numerical relativity, but the initial value problem was his strongest point. Joe Reddish was an undergraduate thesis student of John Wheeler's. Maybe some of his interest in teaching was initiated there. Larry Shepley, who retired many years ago from Texas, was a student of John's and also partly of mine. Finished up just a few year or two after I came down here to Maryland. Of course, Kip is probably John's most distinguished student apart from Feynman, and I'm sure everybody knows about all the activities and contributions he's made and is still making. Ed Taylor is on the education side. He joined with John to write a couple books about relativity for the high school student or the general not-so-fancy student. Anthony Z, I'm not sure exactly, maybe he was an undergraduate also, but undergraduate, went on to be a particle theorist. Roger Penrose came for a postdoc for a substantial period of time, and Dennis Schama, whose name's not on this list yet, well, he wasn't postdoc, he was more senior. Then Robert Garrosh, who's in Chicago now as a professor, and Arthur Fisher, who is a distinguished mathematician in Berkeley, I think he is.
Santa Cruz.
Okay. So there are all these. Christodoulou, there's also stories from him coming up. A very gifted mathematical physicist who's proved things about the existence of singularities. Contradicting Penrose's earliest formulation of cosmic censorship, right. Remo Ruffini spent 10 years at Princeton as a postdoc, assistant professor, etc., and worked with a huge batch of people. I think I found that he had 61 different collaborators from Princeton during his 10 years there. Leonard Parker, I don't know how his connection to John, was he?
He visited in 1970.
Uh-huh.
Sort of stimulated some quantum field theory research.
Uh-huh. Okay. Bob Wald, who, of course, you know from an excellent textbook, and is a professor at Chicago. And Bekenstein, who was famous for his introduction of entropy of a black hole. Yavuz Nutku must have just been an occasional visitor. I mean, he was a student of Chandrasekhar's and did postdocs here. But anyway, he greatly admired Wheeler and Jim Eisenberg was an undergraduate under Wheeler, wrote an undergraduate thesis with Wheeler, and feels that his approach to physics was strongly influenced by that. Claudio Teitelbaum spent many years at the Institute for Advanced Study as a regular visitor and worked with Wheeler. John Wyler, I'll tell you more about later. Larry Ford, Larry Smarr spent, I think, a month at Princeton, felt much inspired by it. And SMAR, well, SMAR is primarily associated with computers, but he came into it through numerical relativity. Isaacson, who was director at NSF for a while, learned how to manipulate the bureaucracy from I'll find the name somewhere. His first move to getting gravitational waves going was to get supercomputers going. And so Isaacson was very important in getting the first round of supercomputers financed around the country for use in science and especially physics, including setting up the Illinois Supercomputer Institute, where Larry Smarr started out in Texas with Bryce DeWitt, who had done computations on the H-bomb or the A-bomb way back when, and knew about computing and was interested in numerical relativity. And so he got Larry Smarr into that, and Larry Smarr did some of the earliest successful work on numerical computing, and then went to Illinois, where he encouraged that and lots of other things, including the web browser, which was invented there while he was the director. And then he continued mostly in that field. But he was an important player in the early stages of numerical relativity. Gary Horowitz, of course, is a professor at Santa Barbara and continues to play an important role in physics. So all these people, including Balogh here, who interacted strongly, Bill Unruh, who just was celebrating a 65th birthday in this summer, and another name here, well, Zirilli, who played an important role in early stages of the perturbations of Schwarzschild, and therefore the ring down idea of signature of black holes that's now very important. Fred Singer was someone who was from John's early stages, cosmic ray physics, and has been a devil's advocate for many years on the unpopular side of numerous questions, currently global warming, but he's done all kinds of things after having done things related to the these bands of trapped particles around the Earth, whose name is attached to that. That's Van Allen, the Van Allen bands. I mean, he was interested in things like that and made contributions to it. So that's a list of the people, a very huge number, actually, of people, large numbers of whom have been done very significant things, were wanting to say things to extend their appreciation to John at that time. So if we go through some details of some of them, Fred Singer has this interesting story. Thesis committee included Oppenheimer and Niels Bohr, started to explain my work. Oppie interjected, took over, held the floor. I sat down while he continued. Bohr fell asleep. And you, John Wheeler, looked very vaguely unhappy. I passed the exam. Okay. Here's a note from Reggie. John had met Reggie at a Rochester conference where he was a grad student in the United States and due to go back to Italy. And then John was impressed by him and invited him to come to Leiden in Holland and found some money to get him there. And then they worked on this perturbations of Schwarzschild. So John's style was fits what's said by other people later, that you should preferably know the answer before you start calculating. So John wrote a paper on the perturbations of Schwarzschild and gave it to Reggie and said, well, here's the outline of what we expect to find. Please fill in the equations. And Reggie says, well, that wasn't a bad way to approach the problem. He said he learned a lot from it and was up to the task. At that time, the nature of the horizon was not understood well, and so I don't think they had the boundary conditions exactly right, but they laid out all the technology that was needed and pointed out that this was an important problem. Here's someone. Right. That the singularity means the horizon, yes.
There's another question about the stability of the singular, what we call singularity today.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Or the approach to it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, what did I get there? Wrong button. Go on. So here's just a story from someone that you probably don't know, but he says, working as a graduate student with John, he was given John's notebook to borrow for a few days, and he thought that was a wonderful experience because he could look in there and see how John goes about organizing his work. John did have this habit for, I guess, all of his life, of having bound notebooks. I looked at one in a bookstore the other day, and nowadays they cost $90 just to get one of these bound books of blank pages. But he had very nice bound books, and they were always there, and when he had a group of students in the office, he would sit down and take notes as the discussion went on. And he would also make notes to himself about the calculations he was doing or the works he planned to do or what were the important questions in physics and so forth. And so this student thought he learned a lot by being able to see into John's way of approaching physics. Those notebooks, incidentally, have been given to the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, and so they are available to researchers. Joe Weber. So it's very likely that Joe Weber picked up this way of handling things from his association with John in the 1950s. Great. Okay, another saying of John Wheeler's, an expert is one who's made every mistake in some field. Well, that's one version of it. The version I remember of John's on mistakes is the way to be a very good physicist is to be able to make mistakes faster than anybody else. So he sort of assumed there's a quota, and you've got to have a certain number before you get to some real progress. Barry Malik, a student who worked with John, here's that quote, never do a calculation unless you know the answer. Another thing that I didn't hear so often, if you really understand a phenomenon, you can build a simple model and explain it to anybody. But that is certainly one of John's teaching attitudes, that if you really understand something, you should be able to explain it to less than your collaborators. He has this phrase, radical conservative. I remember the phrase dynamic conservatism, which, what?
Daring conservatism.
Okay. But anyway, this was a view that John used to justify some of his outrageous work like wormholes and geons and whatnot, quantum foam, but especially on things like wormholes. His attitude there was, you should not just look to a theory to explain the things you know. You should look to the equations and see what they predict, even if you can't imagine why such a thing should be part of physics. And so he wanted to push the equations to their limit and see what's in them. That's the conservatism, and say, we've got these equations, this is principally Einstein's. Why do we just use them in cases where we already understand what to expect? Why don't we push them and see if they've got anything else to tell us that might be a surprise? And so now, as I was having these pages from this privately published book there's only a half dozen copies in the existence, but as having them copied here in our Xerox room, the woman who was running the Xerox looked at this page and she said, "That's my language." So one of our staff is Burmese. Okay. Now, Kip Thorne on John's writing. John had a style of writing that many people were able to recognize, but Kip could do more than recognize it. So he says, one of his students came up with the MTW book and says, "This is just too strange a way to write. Why did you let John Wheeler get away with that?" And Kip said, "Ah, John didn't write that, I did." Kip studied John's style of writing, and that makes it hard to decode MTW. I mean, you can probably find if things are written in a sort of a dull, straightforward way that I had a hand in it, but it's very hard to distinguish Kip from John Wheeler in there. Although John did the introductions to most of the chapters, made sure there was something like this sentence or two that would be meaningful to anybody that's starts things out. The most obvious peculiarity was a sort of Germanic sentence structure in which you try as much as you can in English to put the verb at the end and start out with a bunch of other qualifications until the whole point gets made with emphasis. So here's someone else quoting this question that finding the right answer is never as important as asking the right question. So one of John's things. Jim York wrote a long letter talking about how he got into serious physics by getting a chance to meet John and talk to him, and then John simply used his influence to get Jim invited to the Battelle conference, I guess. That got York into the real meat of the business, and he never slowed down, continued to work very hard making contributions to primarily the initial value problem, but eventually in collaborations with Choquet Brea, many very rigorous results also in that area. Christodoulou was perhaps even younger than John Wheeler as a graduate student. I think he got someone recommended him to John, and John was able to meet him in Paris one year when he was there. Papa Petru sent him. And so John agreed that this was a very outstanding young man and talked Princeton into accepting him in spite of the fact that he was probably hadn't finished high school or something. Again, he got picked up and learned to do physics at Princeton working with John, and very much appreciated the fact that things could be done that way. Here's Remo Ruffini, and as I mentioned, in his letter or in his CV says, while at Princeton, he collaborated with this long list of people, and as I say, I went through, tried to count from his publications and found about 61 different collaborators, I believe. But he was there during 10 years from 67 to 76, I think, roughly, and during a very active time in the development of the physics of black holes. Bob Wald says, one should think in a completely down-to-earth matter and decide by physical intuition what ought to be true first. Then one should obtain a mathematical proof or disproof of one's conjecture. So this is, again, this idea of John, that you really should think through a problem in its broad outlines and take all the clues you could have from other aspects of physics and other ways of thinking about it so that you think you know how to work your way through the problem before you get deep into it. Sergio, he's just someone pointing out this idea of John's inspiration, saying, look, physics is going on today. When you get to your first physics class, you shouldn't just meet Newton and find things that were known 400 years ago, but you should realize that there is real physics going on right now. And, of course, today's Nobel Prizes remind us that there are great discoveries being made right now. But anyway, he was able to get the students in the undergraduate classes to realize that physics is really going on now in a serious way. Jim Eisenberg, I think he's talking here about his PhD thesis done here at Maryland, but anyway, he took it up for John to read, and John wrote across the page, "D-sludge." And the question is, what does all that mean? Well, it means, as you would clean out the garage under your car where it had dripped, you want to get rid of all the junk that's messing things up and causing it to be full of unnecessary words, etc., etc. So teaching has been an important enterprise, he says, and desludged is the only kind he does. So he would work with many of his students on, with lots of effort on the writing, and here Claudio Teitelbaum tells the same thing, that John would spend a lot of time correcting English. He said, John, why are you spending so much time on that? And John says, that's what I'm paid for. And the central idea should always stand out clearly, sharply, just as in Cuba C, Yankee No. That was John's John's address to Teitelbaum on make sure that there's a clearly understandable point. Now, on John's writing, there is this paper in GRG by John A. Wyler, which caused a lot of fun when it first came out. It came out as a Princeton preprint. In those days, with no web, one had standard little reproduced packages of typewritten papers that were sent around to your friends, and so this came around to everybody. And you really had to go for several minutes into that paper before you realized the author was not John A. Wheeler, because, again, he was mimicking John Wheeler's style, and it only slowly got more outrageous than John could be, so that you began to see that it was a spoof. But it was such a good spoof that it later got published. And so you can look it up if you want to. And as you see, Wyler is writing here. Yes. Bill Press did that. And he had all these little... So this was on the letter in this book from John A. Wyler to Wheeler, dictated in Wyler's absence, proofread and signed by the secretary in his presence. So if you have read many things by Wheeler, why you would enjoy reading Wyler. Larry Smarr, again, talking about how John picked him up and gave him a chance to spend a month at Princeton, and that was a very active time. He names all these people who were working actively on black hole-related physics. And so John, when he found a gifted person, would go really out of his way to make sure they got let up and could go somewhere. So now, let's emphasize this. So that's John Wheeler as teacher and researcher. Now let's talk about his impact on relativity. So a brief summary of relativity in the early years is there was a period where cosmology got started. There were some important works in the 30s, the Einstein-Ehrenfeld-Hoffman ideas. There was also a paper on inhomogeneous cosmologies that's been very useful for people. Unified field theories were the bane of GR in those days. Einstein worked on them. Einstein was convinced that that physics should be primarily geometry, and he was trying to stretch the ideas of geometry enough. it's sort of amusing that about 10 years later, maybe 15, Weinberg, Steve Weinberg, was convinced that geometry was irrelevant to physics, and he wrote a textbook on general relativity from a field theory special relativity point of view as much as possible, saying that we really, the geometry is sort of window dressing, it makes things look prettier, but the important stuff is just field theory. And, of course, the peculiar thing is that it was Weinberg's later who proved, basically, collaborated in proving that physics really is geometry, except it's not the geometry of space-time, it's the geometry of the graph paper on which the properties of space-time are represented. So that's the idea of a curved connection, is that if you want to plot the values of any physical quantity of this fundamental importance, electromagnetic field, quarks, gluons, etc., you plot it on curved graph paper. But Einstein didn't have that broad an idea of geometry, so he never got the right track of where geometry really comes predominantly into physics. And then there were people who did straight general relativity who were just very good physicists, but there were limited numbers of them in these early years. Relativity had a very bad reputation among many physicists. So some Caltech professor, not named by Kip, in Kip's book, he reports that as Kip was leaving for Princeton, he was told, general relativity has little relevance to physics. You should look elsewhere for interesting physics. So he was being warned away from relativity as he left Caltech as an undergraduate and went to Princeton as a graduate student. In Russia, Novikov was getting interested in relativity, and Novikov's wife was given advice by senior physicists that she should get Ivor out of it, or he'll never have a career. So she was told relativity is a backwater. Ivor should get out of it. And so this is in Kip Thorne's book. She was a physicist, yeah. Okay. So after the World War II, there were a number of active people of the generation ahead of John's students. And so here's a list of many of the important ones at that time. So Wheeler went into this, and his dynamic conservatism had these mottos, mass without mass. He tried to show that a collection of fields, electromagnetic waves running around in circles, held into circles by gravity, could form an object that had a mass, even though there was nothing there but zero mass fields. And so that was one of the things he was pushing then. Later discovered that the whole system was unstable, but anyway, but went on then to this next thing, proving with Dieter Brill, supervising Brill's thesis, after I had been there pushing on initial conditions for some time, that showed that with a rigorous solution of the initial value equations, you can show that not just approximations, as Wheeler was using up here, in a rigorous way, there are bundles of gravitational waves that have mass. It wasn't an attempt to say there's anything stable about them, but just that you, with nothing but empty space and curvature, you can get mass. The other thing was this charge without charge idea, that with wormholes, which got turned into good geometry, I guess primarily by me, after I'd read the French books by Lichnerowitz and so forth, and got a better, and also a lot of other differential geometry that people were teaching me. But then Finkelstein and Beckedorf, working with me, got completely geometrical views of the horizon, which was then called the Schwarzschild singularity. And so one could make initial conditions corresponding to Wheeler's diagrams of wormholes and show that they really were consistent with the Einstein equations, although one later found out that they wouldn't last long enough for much to happen if you had normal kinds of matter. So those were the dynamic conservatism kinds of ideas. Yes, Ted? Did Wheeler regard extended Schwarzschild as mass without mass? You mean just a vacuum black hole? I think he eventually did, but at the time a lot of this was going on, he was trying to fight black holes. I mean, he was against black holes. That was his concentration, is what is the ultimate fate of a star? And can you... He expected that there would be something to avoid all these singularities, and it took a long time for him to be convinced that... Right. The Finkelstein certainly published the first good interpretation of the Schwarzschild singularity, the real physical one. Yeah. Now, the Beckedorf stuff is published in an obscure place. It was published in the proceedings of a conference on time that Tommy Gold organized at Cornell. I forget exactly when, but... I think not. No, I don't think it was prior to Finkelstein's paper. But it was, in fact, Finkelstein's paper pushed Wheeler into writing the Kruskal paper. So the Kruskal picture, which goes beyond Finkelstein only in unphysical ways, in my view, but anyway, is mathematically satisfying. And so the Beckedorf work came after the Kruskal. But it importantly pointed out how you would match a collapsing star in the Kruskal diagram to the external solution. And so it showed a physical production of a black hole in a way that you could understand better than Oppenheimer and Snyder, because they knew everything, at least everything exterior to the horizon, they had correct, and they knew the physics, and then Oppenheimer just was never interested in that again. Okay. So here, as I say, are his main themes, dynamic, or Dieter says, dressed, daring conservatism, okay? And so look in the physics, get the physics out of the equations, just don't expect them to put the next decimal point on things you already understand. And he encouraged Weber's work on wave detectors. He worked on the Reggie Wheeler perturbations of Schwarzschild. He influenced Sciama and Penrose. I think Penrose gives him credit for pulling him into relativity from algebraic geometry. Sciama, of course, was a strong presence in the astrophysical side, much better astrophysicist than Wheeler, I would think, but in tremendous influence. But he was also encouraged a lot by Wheeler and made visits in the early days to Princeton. And new experiments were going on. The Dickey experimental group, in fact, was right there in Princeton. So Wheeler was doing that. In the early 60s, Wheeler originally started thinking that the singularity ought to be avoided, and then there came all this other work that really made it understandable because it was more geometrical than Oppenheimer-Snyder, what was going on. Brill-Hartl work showing gravitational waves by making a gravitational geon, and the beginnings of numerical relativity in which Hahn and Lindquist made an attempt to actually integrate the Einstein equations in a very simple case. Then as the next decade came on, the Princeton group got much bigger with important work being done by many people, and there were new research groups building up various places. Sciama got many people working with him. I came down here and began to have other students and postdocs. Schilt went to Texas. Thorne, a few years later than me, went to Caltech and began building up a group. Infeld, Chandra came into relativity and attracted people there. Hawking, Ted Newman. Ted Newman is somewhat overlooked, I think, because he was the Newman Penrose stuff. He was the first work on that was Newman, and got cleaned up by Penrose. But the idea of going to null frames was Newman, and the fact that it would simplify the search for solutions of Einstein's equations was, and the discovery of the Kerr solution would have been impossible without the work of Ted Newman. So and then the real astrophysics began coming in, and a lot of other developments came during these last years of that decade I was trying to refer to. So here then are places you can look for some of this stuff. John Wheeler's autobiography with the assistance of Ken Ford, which was published, 8 years ago. Kip Thorne wrote a book 10 or 11 years ago, which has a lot of history of these periods in it. There is this book that Peter Putnam organized, that is, he financed it, and pushed people into it, directed John Wheeler's secretary to send out letters recruiting contributions, and a really elaborate binding of this was given to Wheeler at a GR meeting. It was an absolutely beautiful thing, probably cost even in 77 or 76 $1,000 or $2,000 for the binding. And then half a dozen other copies are around. I have one. The American Institute of Physics across the road has one. Princeton and Texas have some. So they exist, especially at the Center for Physics across the road. One can find it. Then there is this book that I found some interesting history in. And then there is a book in press. I've seen a draft of the book by Kenefick, who is a Caltech physicist who has been doing a lot on the history of physics. And so you can look forward to that as other sources for the history of this area. So with that, I thank you for your attention. Glad to have a chance to be here. Carol Alley.
Charlie, can you tell us more about how Wheeler was influenced by Kruskal? I mean, it's a very curious episode.
Okay, the question.
The paper under Kruskal's name that Kruskal didn't know about. I understand it from Wheeler's autobiography.
Okay, the question is the Kruskal paper and Wheeler's involvement in it. Yes, Kruskal had developed this idea. He was working at Matterhorn, which was where the H-bomb was developed, and so Wheeler knew him from that. He was a plasma physicist, but somehow he had developed this way of looking at the Schwarzschild solution. And John was aware of it, and then after Finkelstein's paper came out, and I think I was probably, because I had collaborated on other things with Finkelstein, I was probably pushing this on Wheeler, and Wheeler, this is my recollection, Wheeler decided that this ought to be published and told Kruskal, who didn't seem interested, and so Wheeler sat down and wrote a paper. And then the rest I get from, basically from Wheeler's autobiography. Wheeler then submitted the paper, whose author was listed as Kruskal only. He submitted the paper to Fizrov, and some months later, Kruskal got proofs to correct. And that's when he realized all this was going on. So that's the story as I know it. Don't know. He wasn't somebody I really knew.
Yeah.
But obviously he didn't cancel the paper.
So the paper was published
in the end? Oh, the paper was published, yeah.
Which
man? Kruskal. I mean, there's no indication in the paper that... I don't think Wheeler wrote in wrote in an acknowledgement of Wheeler's assistance. You can look for that, but I doubt that it's there. Yeah, Ted. Okay, so the question is the transformation from Wheeler's approach to trying to find a way to avoid a singularity to where he accepted black holes. I was somewhat present for that. Actually, the thing that surprises me most is that I heard about Oppenheimer-Snyder from... I didn't hear about it from Wheeler. I heard about it from Sam Freeman. And I think that's because Wheeler had a batch of graduate students, and he had them started out, and I was doing geometry, you know, mass without mass, and initial value equations, and some quantum gravity, the Feynman approach, and so forth. So I just wasn't on his team for singularities, which was Kip Thorne and several others. So I guess that's... So he didn't really talk a lot to me, and I just looked on. But as the question came up with Finkelstein's paper of being able to see what the horizon really was, why, it was clear to me that in principle, and Wheeler was always saying it's a point of principle what's going to happen, in principle, the equation of state of nuclear matter was irrelevant, because if you just had a galactic-sized black hole, the density of matter near the horizon didn't need to be more than the density of water or something like that. So, but I didn't challenge Wheeler and say, look, everything you've done for the past 3 years is nonsense or irrelevant. But I did try to make that point. And someplace in the Lazus lectures, he has a long Lazus lecture, you know, 100 pages. Someplace in there, he does recognize that for larger masses, there is the densities do not have to be high, and high densities can't, in fact, prohibit. I mean, the behavior of matter of high densities can't prohibit large black holes. But by that time, I was here in Maryland. As that, I think 63, I was here. I think it's the 63 summer school that's in. So I really don't know when the change comes, but Kip Thorne would have been around, and if you read his book on black holes, you'll probably get as good a picture of how the change actually came as any. But I would hope that my presentation of collapse at this gold conference, which Wheeler and many others were at, had some influence on people's thinking.
Charlie, there's another episode. Wheeler gave a lecture at the Goddard Institute in New York at which he talked about this concept, and someone in the audience yelled out, black hole. Now, I think that was Remo Ruffini, but in Wheeler's autobiography, he doesn't identify who that person.
Nope, I have no idea. I wasn't conscious of that going on as it happened. So.
What year was that, Carol?
What's that?
What year was that?
Well, I don't remember, Balak. I think Ramo has told me that it was he. But
I think.
I was wanting to get some independent.
Yeah. Okay, Ted.
What was your model of collapse? I mean, you get, was it just a shell, a thin shell of matter? Is a very simple.
No, the Bekenstein senior thesis. He was a mathematics student. His senior. Beckedorf. Beckedorf. The Beckedorf senior thesis was to take the zero pressure Friedman universe, take a P piece of that, a ball of that, and match it using the matching of first and second fundamental forms to the exterior Schwarzschild, where to get, make the match happen that way, the boundary has to be a geodesic in both solutions. And so he put that all together and made that. And at this gold conference, I drew the pictures of that and described the collapse that way.
It doesn't describe formation of a trapped surface or a horizon theorem or
anything. No. I don't think so, because the, I mean, if you make it time symmetric, of course the matter collapses from infinity. No, the Friedman universe expands and recontracts, but the. I think the point is that you could just cut it off at time zero and replace it by a static Schwarzschild solution and say that you threw a switch and the pressure was removed from the interior. And from then on it collapses. That's sort of the picture that Oppenheimer had anyway, to say that, well, once things get going, pressures won't be big enough to make a difference, so I'll do the pressure-free case. And that match works perfectly well. You just take the interior Schwarzschild solution with pressure finite down to the origin, and that's static up to time zero. And at time zero, some chemical reaction causes the pressure to disappear, and it collapses. And that second half is all described by a Friedman universe, matched to Schwarzschild. Carol is asking about a 1939 paper by Einstein in which he tries to show that Oppenheimer-Schneider isn't correct and can't occur. As I say, Wheeler never even mentioned in the days I was a student to him the Oppenheimer-Schneider to me. And so I certainly know nothing about that interaction. One would get the impression from some of the things Wheeler said that Oppenheimer was unwilling to discuss gravity. He was thought particle physics was more important. What? The question was, what are my fondest recollections of working with John?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Well, I don't know. I don't think I've collected a set of favorites. I certainly enjoyed working with John at all times. And, you know, his... Well, let's start with how I got to work with him. I had been a graduate student for a year and at Princeton and passed my qualifyings, and so it was time to choose a thesis advisor. During that first year, since I'd had so many graduate courses and things at Notre Dame, I didn't take many courses and worked on double beta decay with Art Whiteman. So the first person I went to talk to was Art Whiteman. And he said yes, he'd be glad to have me as a student, but he felt as a matter of conscience or something, he should just point out that his current student, who was just finishing up, had spent 7 years and was writing a thesis that was two volumes long and 900 pages and something and so forth. So he just wanted me to know what I was getting into in this kind of highly rigorous mathematics of field theory. And I went and talked to John Wheeler and said, what can we do, and so forth. And I told him, well, I'd had lots of topology. I understood about some of the mathematics of wormholes and things like that. And he was also interested in quantum mechanics and finding some over histories. And he said, well, he thought it would be nice if someone would work out the Feynman sum over histories for general relativity, and maybe I could do that. And he said these are probably pretty important problems, but they're not necessarily hard problems. You should be able to do it in a year or so. So anyway, he seemed much more like the prospects were a lot more lively there. And, you know, he had groups of students working with him. Well, not he didn't have groups at that time, but he had this way of talking to students a lot and so forth. So I just decided, well, probably life will be at least as interesting and so forth if I went with John Wheeler. So I started out trying to do this sum over histories and then got into all the topology and things like that and worked on what John called already unified theory. It was an idea that came from, well, Hugh Everett pointed out to me in a book, textbook. I'm so bad on names. I have to come back to it. Reinisch, yes. In a textbook on Reinisch that you could characterize the curvatures that could arise from a Maxwell stress energy tensor algebraically by a few simple equations on the Einstein tensor. And Hugh Everett has said, wouldn't it be nice if you could also get the Maxwell equations in terms of that? So I worked on that for a while. And then after I had it all figured out, Peter Berg, John wrote to people telling him about it, and Peter Bergman wrote back and said, well, that's already been done by Reinisch in such and such a paper. He just hadn't bothered to mention it in his textbook. That he had finished the problem as well as starting it. So at that point, I had to quickly switch gears. I'd prepared long papers with Wheeler on geometrodynamics, that is, this mass without mass, wormholes, things like that. So those papers were getting published. So then Wheeler sent me back to do Feynman quantization, and I just wrote up something quickly. As an article for the Reviews of Modern Physics in 1957, which was the Chapel Hill Conference, and that article was accepted as my thesis. So, it wasn't 700 pages.
By the way, I have to say this for completeness. Wasn't the answer to the question of how would you write the Maxwell equations as equations on the Einstein tensor, the answer was you don't have to. They're already implied by the Einstein equations.
No. No. No, there's a differential condition that has to be satisfied, because there are two sets of Maxwell's equations and there's only one. So the Bianchi identities give you a linear combination of the two sets of Maxwell's equations. So if you can get one of them taken care of some other way, the other follows there. So there still is a condition. And the real solution to that problem was given some years later by Penrose and never published until Balogh organized this meeting here for celebrating birthdays of Dieter and myself. And Penrose then contributed 20 years later a discussion which says that this already unified theory, even if you didn't worry about the fine points of being able to resolve 0 over 0 every so often, that even if it had worked smoothly, you had to give up the Cauchy problem. There is no Cauchy problem for that, because it takes to know whether two bundles of electromagnetic fields are both electric or one's electric and the other is magnetic. You have to have seen them interact sometime in the past or in the future. But you have to have knowledge of the electromagnetic fields over the gravitational fields over possibly large periods of time before you can tell that the electromagnetic fields that are generating them are how much of it is electric and how much is magnetic, because in the energy density, both and momentum, each electric and magnetic contribute equally. And so you lose the Cauchy problem. To have a process in which the present determines the future, you need the information that's stored in the electromagnetic field. It can't just get it out of...
Is that another way of saying that you can only reconstruct the field strength up to a duality
and
rotation?
That's right. And but eventually, as fields overlap, that duality rotation will change the geometry if it happens on one piece and not another. Yeah.
I should say that the reason that Penrose's article is in that volume is I begged him to publish it, and then he said, I haven't looked at it in 20 years or whatever it was. And, it never was complete in the first place, and I just said, I don't care.
Yeah, I think, in fact, in the published version, he mentions this and says one page of his old notes was missing and he had to try to reconstruct them for the article. Okay, thank you.